If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Trump's 4th of July speech at Mount Rushmore sets off some fireworks in the press, plus the Supreme Court rules on faithless electors. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined, as usual, by my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
On Friday evening, the night before Independence Day, President Trump gave a speech basically in the shadow of the four big presidential heads at Mount Rushmore. There was a flyover by the Blue Angels. There were actual fireworks. There was Lee Greenwood's music on the loudspeaker. Trump lauded the founders. He lauded the Declaration of Independence. There were some sharp attacks on cancel culture. But, I mean, to my eye, it was pretty much standard 4th of July fare. And Kim, that is not how it was reported in the media. I mean, a New York Times news headline called it a divisive culture war message. The Washington Post is now editorializing that, quote, Trump plumbed new depths of depravity, unquote. What's going on here?
It strikes me that what's going on here is, unfortunately, what you see too often. You turn on the news and it's as if you live in parallel universes. I think a lot of people watched that Trump speech and felt that it was one of the best speeches of his presidency, in that he was trying to rally the country behind what are traditional American principles, ones that are right now under a lot of assault from people on the radical left. And so you had him out there talking about many of the familiar themes about how the United States has done more to advance the human condition than any other country. He talked about many of the founders and important people in history and the need to point out how important they have been and to keep them as our heroes in a certain degree. And it was not divisive in that he talked about both white Americans and black Americans, both in history, that have done amazing things. He talked about Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King. I think the media understood that this was what he was trying to do. They didn't like the fact that it was actually a pretty good speech, and just in classic media fashion these days are determined to cast anything the president does as something malignant for the nation.
I would make a couple points. I mean, the first one being that Joe Biden also put out a 4th of July message, a video about a minute and a half long. And to my eye, he struck similar notes as the Trump speech. I mean, so here's a couple quotes from Joe Biden's message. He says, "Our country was founded on an idea. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." He said, "Once proposed, it was an idea that couldn't be constrained. These words have gnawed our conscience and pulled us towards justice." And President Trump, you know, here's a couple lines from his speech. He said that the founders, quote, enshrined a divine truth that changed the world forever when they said all men are created equal. These immortal words set in motion the unstoppable march of freedom. Our founders boldly declared that we are all endowed with the same divine rights. Bill, I mean, you could almost switch the names on those, and it's pretty much standard 4th of July material.
Yeah, I actually don't believe that. I think actually Biden's speech, a lot of it was given over to systemic racism. He complained about Donald Trump and so forth. I also don't think Biden means this stuff. You know, recently he was asked about statues and he did say, you know, he would distinguish between a Confederate general and thinks statues of Washington and Jefferson, like the Jefferson Memorial, should be protected. I'd be very doubtful that Joe Biden would protect those statues. I mean, whatever you say about Donald Trump, you know, he's issued this executive order. He wants people punished. And no Democrat, so far as I can see, has done that. You know, I think Trump's speech, to me, Donald Trump, I once wrote a column, this, Donald Trump is George M. Cohan. It's patriotism and it's excess, you know, gazillion flags, our fighter jets, you know, flying over and everything, huge backdrops like Mount Rushmore, you know, and in the movie about George M. Cohan, Yankee Doodle Dandy, at one point someone asked him, Mr. Cohan, what's the reason you've been successful? And he said, I'm just an ordinary guy who knows what ordinary guys like. I think that's what was so inspiring about Trump's Mount Rushmore speech. I think he just spoke to ordinary Americans, how they looked at it. And I think Joe Biden sometimes says some of the right things, but I would be surprised. None of them have been able to condemn the criminality. That's what this is about. This is not about historical judgments. Mobs don't make historical distinctions. It's about the destruction of private property, the disenfranchisement of the Democratic people who have a right to make these decisions themselves. And I just don't buy that any Democrat is willing to stand up to them.
I take those points, Bill. I guess what I was trying to say was just that the underlying message here, that there's something admirable in our founders, was coming both from Joe Biden and from Donald Trump. And as far as the scenery goes, I mean, there was some chatter about the problematic setting of Mount Rushmore with two presidents who owned slaves. But Kim, I mean, there are some clips surfacing that are really interesting. I mean, way back in ancient history of 2016, you had Bernie Sanders, who stopped at Mount Rushmore while campaigning, and he called it, quote, our country at its best. He said, it really does make one very proud to be an American. There were CNN reporters calling it a fitting spot for a presidential contender to stop. And so this change in views, it has really come very fast.
Yeah, and it comes down to two things. One, the first that I had mentioned, that anything that Donald Trump does is now orange man bad. And so you have to take the opposite view or say the opposite of whatever he has done. You have to condemn where he goes and anything that comes out of his mouth. That's part of it. The other part of it is just a sign of our recent, in the last year, attitude that's been rising, especially in the last few months, that goes to political correctness and the sort of Black Lives Matter movement, which is now bled into things like, apparently you can no longer hail Mount Rushmore because it sits on land that was once owned by the Lakota Sioux tribe. And supposedly, you know, this land was stolen. I mean, as we were talking about earlier today among colleagues, if that's going to be your standard, then, you know, you're going to have to give back Manhattan as well, too. But no one tends to think these ideas through. And you have so many aggrieved identity politics groups out there at the moment, and all of them are claiming some sort of abuse in the past. And politicians, for whatever reason, have all kowtowed to this and now decided that you can no longer be patriotic, that somehow patriotic is wrong. You can't admire any statues. You can't admire anything that happened in the history of the country. And one thing that is remarkable to me, to round back to those first headlines, you talked about criticizing Trump's Mount Rushmore speech, talking about how supposedly he was being divisive and he is stoking divisiveness in the country. That's the pot calling the kettle. That this is the other side, is the side that has decided that everything must be a flashpoint and that we must be divided onto whether or not you are the right or wrong side of history.
Yeah. And Bill, it does seem like there is a movement that wants to make American patriotism taboo. I mean, any admiration for the founders, what they set up, any gratefulness that they wrote the First Amendment, for example. I mean, there's another, I'll read a couple more headlines. There's a New York Times opinion headline that says, I'm a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson, take down his memorial. There's a Washington Post opinion headline. Both namesakes of Washington and Lee University perpetrated racial terror. The school should be renamed. Where is this coming from, Bill? I mean, I can't imagine that a majority of voters, if you ask them, should we start taking down the Jefferson Memorial, that they would say yes. So where is this coming from?
Absolutely, Kyle. And I think there's a movement that Kim alluded to. It's a very sophisticated movement. and it has clear purposes, and you can see it in the New York Times 1619 project. That is a project that deliberately set out to rewrite American history and place our founding not in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, but in 1619 with the arrival of slavery. And from that, they conclude that America is corrupted by slavery and always has been. And that's, if you accept that, then it sort of makes sense. Oh, I don't care whether it was Ulysses S. Grant or Robert E. Lee or George Washington or Jefferson Davis. They're all bad in some ways. And it makes there's a rationale to it. Unfortunately, I think that's a dominant theme in today's Democratic Party. I think it's also the root of, you know, what they call systemic racism. And I think Joe Biden's going to have to deal with it. Again, we talk about the founding. I'd like to ask Joe Biden what his opinion is of the statue of Caesar Rodney, the most famous Delaware citizen in American history. He famously rode 80 miles through a storm on horseback while he's dying of cancer to cast a deciding vote for Delaware for independence. Yet his statue was removed from Wilmington Square. So you just see these people are afraid to stand up against that. And it is all about, as you suggest, Kyle, it's all about the legitimacy of the American founding and America today. And the argument is that we're no one can escape this this taint.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. While we're talking about Joe Biden, there was an interesting moment, Kim, when Senator Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, who is being vetted as potentially Joe Biden's running mate, potentially the next vice president, potentially a president down the line, was asked on TV. She was on TV and asked if statues of, for example, George Washington should come down. And she equivocated. I mean, she said, we should start off by having a national dialogue at some point. She said, I think we should listen to everybody. I mean, that's the person who could be Joe Biden's running mate and could be the vice president in a matter of months, not answering the question of whether we should take down the statues of George Washington.
And you just explained why she didn't answer the question, because she is running to be Joe Biden's running mate. And everyone right now is terrified of getting on the wrong side of the progressive left. And so you have politicians that cave to that and don't even have the courage to stand up and say, for goodness sake, no, we shouldn't be taking down statues of George Washington. But look, I do think that this goes a long way to explaining why we are at this moment, as the lack of voices on the left at the moment pushing back against this craziness. You know, Bill alluded to this earlier. You haven't seen Joe Biden really take a firm stance on this. You know, he was asked as well about tearing down statues, and he equivocated himself in that he said, well, you know, it would be better that if we have a discussion about this and it be done in a democratic fashion. But, you know, you can certainly see the outrage, and he left open the idea that it was okay for this to happen. We need more people in prominent positions among on the liberal side who are willing to come out and say there is a distinction between not all statues are created equal, and that this is ridiculous. We can have a patriotic love of our founding fathers and appreciate what they gave to our country while also acknowledging that not every one of them was absolutely perfect, and that we can't simply disappear our entire history and make those points. But we're just not hearing those voices on the other side.
But what about the national press, Bill? I mean, if a majority of Americans would outright dismiss the idea of taking down a statue of George Washington, for example, wouldn't you think that the national media that is talking to those readers, to those viewers, would be at least somewhat of a reflection of their views. I mean, is it just that there's a sort of an echo chamber going on here? I mean, there was an interesting study I saw last month where some academics mapped tweets between Beltway journalists that have congressional press credentials. And here's their analysis. So the academics write, findings suggest Washington journalists may be operating in even smaller, more insular micro bubbles than previously thought, raising additional concerns about vulnerability to groupthink and blind spots. I mean, is that part of what's going on here? Just that everybody is responsive to the tweets that are coming in on the over the transom?
I think you're absolutely right, Kyle. That is, the bubble has always been a problem, especially for people in the Beltway and in the media. And we associate with ourselves. We don't get out much. I remember being at a press conference once years ago. And in this press conference, you know, Mrs. New York Times was married to Mr. Newsweek and Mr. Time Magazine was married to someone else. It was, you know, and that's who we socialized with, played cards with, and, you know, went on outings with. I think it's, they are in a bubble. That said, I think the country is definitely polarized and there is a market for this point of view. If you look at the comments on a New York Times article, you know, that takes, say, a very liberal or progressive view, you'll find the readers are often far further to the left than the authors of the Times. In fact, they're usually denouncing them for not being sufficiently progressive on this. So if you're talking about a silent majority, I think there's a better point there that no one's speaking up for this. For example, it just seems to be assumed in the press that all African Americans are for all this chaos and destruction. I don't think that's true. I think that does a disservice to the many African Americans who have served in the military. I don't think they regard this as a great thing. You remember Robert, what's his name, of Black Entertainment TV, said, you know, black people laugh at white people for doing all this stuff. So it is a very narrow point of view, and it reflects a narrow segment of the public. Or I'll put it this way: not reflects, it leaves out a big portion of the American public.
You know, it's interesting, Bill, that you bring up Robert Johnson. I was just looking at something and remembering something that he said on that I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And so he's the Black Entertainment Television co-founder, and he's a, you know, billionaire philanthropist. And his direct quote is that, you know, the people who are tearing down statues, he says, they really have no agenda other than the idea that we're going to topple a statue. It's not going to close the wealth gap. It's not going to give a kid whose parents can't afford college money to go to college. It's not going to close the labor gap between what white workers are paid and what black workers are paid. And it's not going to take people off welfare or food stamps. And end quote. And I think that that's a really important point too, which is that, I mean, look, even us, we're sitting around here talking about statues. And you know, it isn't a moment, and this is a discussion, but it's not the real discussion. And I think that that's also what was important about Donald Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore, which it went to that point, which is one of the things that we celebrate in this country, and one of the things the founders made sure was a bedrock of this country, was opportunity and the ability for people to succeed. And to the extent we're currently talking about inequality out there, we should be talking about ways in which we provide better opportunity to all. And a lot of the people that President Trump alluded to in that speech, of all different races and types throughout history, have been those that have been promoted the idea.
So one of the
opportunity for all, and a statue has absolutely nothing to do with those issues.
So one of the ways that Trump brought up in his speech to push back against this a little bit is to create this national garden of American heroes, a vast garden, he says, where there would be statues of some of the very best Americans that represent American ideals. I mean, Bill, do you think that is a good way to push back or to reinvigorate some true patriotism?
Well, again, it seems to me it's thoroughly Donald Trump. It's this idea. It's undiluted patriotism and pride in these people. It involves presumably statues. So you're putting a park full of statues that would be protected. And I think my prediction is that for most of the press and the people that that Kim mentioned, you know, everything he does is divisive. This is going to be seen as very, very cheesy and lowbrow and unnecessary and divisive. And I think ordinary people would love it.
The executive order that he is signing sets up a task force, and the task force within 60 days is supposed to propose some ideas, including potential locations. And it suggests statues. The executive order suggests statues of John Adams, Clara Barton, Frederick Douglass, Ronald Reagan, the Wright brothers, just to name a few. But Kim, is this just going to be the next proxy war of who goes into the National Garden of American Heroes, and the next administration will come in and take some people out?
Oh, possible. You can imagine that might be the case. The executive order did provide a list of figures that will receive a statue. And I think it was quite a fascinating list. You know, it ranged not just from the people you mentioned, people of true sort of historic figures, but even more recent ones. Like, for instance, Billy Graham was on the list. And Antonin Scalia was on the list. George S. Patton was on the list, you know, but along with, as you say, the Wright brothers and Harriet Tubman, Harriet Beecher Stowe. I was thrilled to see her on the list. She's one of my favorite writers. At the same time, the task force includes the chairs of the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the chair of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. And they're also supposed to talk about their ideas of who they think should get a monument. So this thing might indeed need to be, quote, vast, because I would imagine that list is going to get very long indeed at some point.
Well, and if Antonin Scalia is there, you can bet that there will be a Ruth Bader Ginsburg statue there before long. But to extend the conversation a little bit beyond the patriotism point, I mean, there does seem to be a broader issue, whether it's driven by social media or not, of what people are calling cancel culture. I mean, Columbus, Ohio ejected a Columbus statue last week. A Boeing executive lost his job when another employee complained about an article that he wrote 33 years ago, arguing that women shouldn't be given combat roles. And, you know, that the article may not look great in retrospect, but that's longer than the statutes of limitations for some really ugly crimes. The KIPP Charter School Network abandoned its motto bill. I mean, what is to be done about all this?
Well, I think this is, again, what happens when you start thinking, you know, mobs can make historical decisions. And it points to something else that you're kind of hinting at, Kyle. There's no logical end to this. I was just reading a story about one of my alma maters. I went to graduate school at Boston University. There are now people complaining about the dog that's the mascot because his name is Rhett, for Rhett Butler. And the color of the team is scarlet. So Scarlet O'Hara and Rhett, this dog. How many people look at this dog and have any idea of Gone with the Wind or justification? But there's no end. This logic is a logic of destruction and a logic of sort of a secular Puritan intolerance for any sins that ordinary people have. And I don't think there is an end. And I think there's a direct line between this kind of thing and, as you mentioned, canceling a professor, canceling other. This is not a movement for more debate. You know, when people say we should debate whether to take down Washington, this is not a movement for more debate and to have a historical discussion. This is a movement to shut people out of debate. That's what it's primarily about. And statues are only incidental.
Finally, on Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that faithless electors can be punished, essentially, if they go to the Electoral College and vote for someone that their state did not support in the popular vote. 32 states have laws essentially compelling electors to follow their state's will, but that means that other electors are potentially free agents. Kim, what's the significance of this ruling?
Well, one significance, it was, by the way, a unanimous Supreme Court. You did have Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch writing separately. to challenge the other seven justice majority's rationale on this, just arguing that they don't, that states don't have the power to discipline electors under Article 2, but rather under the 10th Amendment. So it was a constitutional question in terms of their rationale, but they all got to the same place. And I think the most important immediate question is that it means that this isn't likely to be an issue in the 2020 election, and that in 2016, there were several electors that had been pledged to Donald Trump, in the end voted against him. And so you're not likely to have that happen, or it shouldn't actually be consequential in 2020. I think the bigger question, which didn't get addressed, is this growing number of Democratic states that have signed on to an anti-electoral college initiative, in which instead of using the traditional electoral college grounds for granting electors, they would instead give all their electors to the winner of the nationwide popular vote. And it's going to be a big question at some point about whether or not an interstate compact like that can happen without Congress's say-so under the Constitution. So that'll probably, though, be the next thing that comes up. And we're going to be reading a lot more about electors as we go along.
There were some commentators, primarily on the left, who were saying that the Supreme Court decision was a win for that popular vote idea. And I guess the argument is that if states can bind their electors any way they want, then let's say for the sake of argument that Texas joins this popular vote compact, and if the people of Texas vote for a Republican candidate, but the overall popular vote is won by the Democrat, then Texas can bind its electors to vote for the Democrat who won the who won the popular vote nationwide, even though Texas did not go for that candidate. I mean, Bill, do you buy that argument, or I mean, is this vote compact essentially unconstitutional for other reasons?
Well, I'm sort of with Kim. I think there's a big question. You know, the ruling that they just issued was basically that states have the right to set the terms on electors. The question is, do they have the right to set terms that kind of basically erases the distinction between the Electoral College and the popular vote? And we haven't decided that yet. I think it's an open question, because I think a lot of states are going to be looking for ways around and what they can do. So I think it's an open question what's going to come next, what the court would accept and what they won't accept.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.